While the number of unaccompanied minors from El Salvador, Honduras, and Guatemala fleeing to the U.S. has dropped dramatically in the last few months, the crisis is not over. Tens of thousands of children and teens were processed at the border and are now living with family or in foster homes or shelters across the country. It's estimated that 500 minors are in Pennsylvania, more than 2,000 are in New Jersey, and almost 200 in Delaware. They are in legal limbo until an immigration court can determine their status or whether they will be sent back from where they came from. It's our topic for today's Radio Times. And let me introduce our two guests who have joined us here in our Philadelphia studio. Kathy Tillman is founder and executive director of La Puerta Abierta, which stands for The Open Door, working to ensure quality mental health services for vulnerable youth and their families, has been working with some of these young people with offices in Kensington, South Philadelphia, and in Upper Darby. And Kathy Tillman, nice to have you with us.
Thank you.
On Radio Times. Also with us is Elizabeth Yeager, staff attorney with Hyas, Pennsylvania. She represents children in immigration court and before the Department of Homeland Security. And Elizabeth, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you.
I think we all remember those pictures of these children streaming over the border into Texas, some of them, you know, sleeping on the floor in some of these centers where they were held. And I'm wondering, how does a child who enters the country in Texas, let's say unaccompanied, end up in Pennsylvania? And I'm going to put that to you, Kathy. How does that happen?
Well, typically the way it happens, and that's a question that's posed very frequently, typically it is when there's either a family member that's been identified. It could be a parent, but it's oftentimes an extended family member, not necessarily a family member that the child has known in the past or perhaps knew many, many years ago. So that's one way. And the other way is that if there is an identified foster family, if the child is truly without any family that's identified in the U.S., then there are different agencies around the country that do oversee foster care placement. And so some of the children are placed in this area just because they could be housed here.
Are they also in shelters or in homes? Do we know?
In homes, meaning?
Like group homes or?
We don't have any group homes that I'm aware of in the Philadelphia area, but they, like I said, they're typically placed either, or they are placed with family members, whether it's, as I said, a parent or extended family member, or in foster care. So as far as shelters, group homes, and so on, there in the Philadelphia area, there are none that I'm aware of.
We're talking about children. Mm-hmm. What ages are we talking about?
Well, the most recent, the youngest that we had referred to us is five.
5 years old?
Yes. She was reunited with her mother. It's a new situation that we're working with, but what we do know is that she was essentially abandoned in her home country, and the mother was able to get her across the border and reunited with her. Mm. But the typical age, I would say, ranges from 14 to 16.
So teenagers.
Yeah.
Teenagers. Mm-hmm. What's their legal status? This is to you, Elizabeth.
Sure. So when these children enter the country, and if they're detained by immigration authorities, which for the most part they are crossing the border, they're identified as unaccompanied children by the fact that they came into the country without a parent or legal guardian at that time. Being an unaccompanied child does not grant you any legal status under the law. What it does do is require that the immigration authorities then transfer you over to the custody of the Office of Refugee Resettlement, which is a different federal agency under the Department of Health and Human Services, and then the Office of Refugee Resettlement, or ORR, is the one who's then responsible for reunifying these children where possible with a relative, or in some limited instances, placing them with a foster family if they truly have no one to go to and if they're identified to have a potential remedy in immigration court. So, you know, from there, by virtue of the fact that they've been detained, they've come into contact with the immigration authorities, they're placed in removal proceedings in immigration court. And so just as any adult who comes into contact with ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, they have to go to immigration court. They have to present whatever defense they might have, if they're able to and eligible for it, to stay in the United States.
there were stories and many stories of these young people, in a sense, giving themselves up to Border Patrol. I mean, not coming into the country to sneak into the country per se, but really to give themselves over to Border Patrol. Mm-hmm. You're nodding your head, Kathy.
Yeah, we've heard that it's become, I think 2-3 years ago it wasn't as common. What we hear through the stories from both, you know, the families and the children is that it's actually a safer way to get here. You know, they don't really know what the implications of turning themselves in, but they know that at least they will have a place to stay where they can't be further hurt, because, as we know, the journey itself is full of peril. And when they finally get here, even if they're sleeping on a floor, even if they're you know, with many, many other kids that are in the same circumstance, they are relatively safer than everything that led up to that point of crossing.
And I do want to get back to that. Let me turn to you, Elizabeth, because there is the Trafficking Victims Protection Act of 2008. What does this act say, and how does this possibly apply to these unaccompanied minors?
So the Trafficking Victims Protection Act, or TVPRA, of 2008 did a couple of things. One of the things that it did was it kind of refined some of the procedures around placing children into ORR care rather than keeping them in the hands of ICE, ICE being the agency that deals with adult immigrant detention. And so under some of these protections that have come about as a result of federal lawsuits and several changes in the law, one of which was the TVPRA, these children have to be turned over to ORR, and their best interests are considered when ORR is deciding where to place them. The TVPRA also refined one of the protections in the law that's available for some of these children, making clear that children who've been abandoned or neglected or abused by their parents or by one of their parents, and where it's not in their best interest to return to their home country for that reason, can qualify for a special immigration status here in the U.S. in order to be protected.
Because it's the trafficking victim. So it's more than just the protections for children who have been sexually trafficked.
Sure. So it's a broader law that amended a prior Trafficking Victims Act, and so there's certain portions of it that deal with specifically with unaccompanied children.
And this is a complicated series of laws, I guess, and also a series of departments of government dealing with various aspects of these unaccompanied minors.
Yeah, absolutely. So all of these children have to appear in immigration court. Sometimes their case requires that they go to family court as well. Sometimes their case also requires that they go to USCIS, which is an immigration agency separate from the immigration court, whether that's to pursue a special visa for trafficking victims or a special status for abandoned or abused or neglected children, or to pursue asylum. In fact, children who are pursuing asylum are entitled to first have their case heard by this separate agency in a non-adversarial environment before they would take it in front of the judge. So it's really a complicated web of agencies that these people, and in this case children, are coming up against when they're talking about trying to pursue their legal case.
And how many of these children have legal representation? I know you represent some children, but we're talking about possibly 90,000 or 50,000 to 90,000 children?
Sure. I mean, I guess that's the number that's been getting thrown around nationally. How many of these kids have entered the United States this year? I think we heard something like it was up to 60,000 by this summer and expected to be around 90,000 by the end of the year. Here in Pennsylvania, I think in the first half of the year, it was something like 500 children that were reunified locally. We at Highest Pennsylvania are certainly seeing an increase in the numbers of children calling us asking for legal services. Very sadly, we just don't have the resources to represent every single child. But there's a huge need for legal representation. The immigration court in Philadelphia has now followed the lead of some of the immigration courts in other big cities, wherein the one judge is assigned all of the juvenile cases and holds a special juvenile docket twice per month. Currently, there's about 90 cases on each of those days being heard by this one judge.
So 90 cases in one day.
Of just juveniles, yeah.
Let me go back to you, Kathy. And we're talking about children coming from El Salvador, Honduras, and Guatemala, three different countries. But what are they leaving? What were they leaving behind? Why did they want to come to the United States?
Well, we call them the Northern Triangle countries, and you know, keep in mind that those three countries combined is about the size of, I think, Maryland or Delaware. I mean, it's not a large geographic area. So a lot of the dynamics that are going on politically and socially and economically in those countries, there's a lot of crossover. So we could say with some confidence that the stories that we hear from children that are leaving Honduras, as an example, are very similar to what we hear from children leaving the other countries. And very typically, and of course it takes a while to finally hear the real stories, they're always stories of trauma. So both interpersonal trauma within the families, where there's been a lot of abuse and neglect, and of course we as therapists understand that the intergenerational trauma is, we're not surprised when we hear this, because there are no resources in these countries to deal with these kinds of dynamics within the family. So they're not only perpetuated from generation to generation, but they're compounded. And then in addition to that, you have the added stress and reality of the drug cartels and the drug gangs. And, you know, I've been doing this work for many, many years, but I still I find the horrific stories, and they seem to be increasing, and the brutality that we're hearing. And so the children report things that we know, you know, happen in a lot of refugee communities where they have been witness to things that are just so terrifying that we literally have heard stories where children have watched somebody being murdered in front of them, and they literally just grab what they can and they run. So it's not like this kind of, you know, planning and packing your suitcase and deciding when you're taking the next bus. I mean, they literally oftentimes will run for their lives.
Are the gangs also trying to recruit these young people?
Absolutely, absolutely. And they maybe will be recruiting a cousin or a sibling, and not only recruiting the boys, but we also know that girls are oftentimes, quote-unquote, recruited to be the girlfriends of gang members, and then if they turn them down, there are some really horrible consequences. So there's a combination of many factors as to why they leave.
I mean, it sounds like sort of external violence in the communities that they live in, mm-hmm. and internal within the family as well.
Within the families, right. And the families, you know, unfortunately, there's also the element of lawlessness. So it's not as though you can go to the authorities and find safety in reporting or having some kind of, you know, approach to regulating this kind of behavior. It is so out of control that oftentimes, unfortunately, the officials are part of the problem. So, you know, we hear of stories of officials that are also participating in a lot of this brutality.
Let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. We are talking about what happened to those thousands of young people from Central America who entered the United States earlier this year. They have settled in places all over the country, including here in the Philadelphia area. Talking with Kathy Tillman, the executive director of La Puerta Abierta, that's the open door program, which is here in Philadelphia and in Upper Darby. Also with us, Elizabeth Yeager, staff attorney with Hyas, Pennsylvania. Any questions or comments? And to join our conversation, that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. We'll be right back.
Montgomery School supports WHYY, an independent school for pre-K through grade 8. Montgomery School believes when children find joy in learning, they are inspired to explore their world and succeed in their educational pursuits. Montgomery's teachers help bring out the best in each student. The school will host an open house on October 26th at 1 p.m. on their campus in Chester Springs. Details at montgomeryschool.org/admissions. Montgomery School, inspired to explore, prepared to succeed.
Ego Poe Classic Theater supports WHYY and presents the American Giants Festival, featuring three works by celebrated playwrights Arthur Miller, Tennessee Williams, and Eugene O'Neill. The festival premieres this month with the Philadelphia revival of Arthur Miller's iconic play, Death of a Salesman, honoring the playwright's 100th anniversary. Miller's Jewish roots are faithfully unearthed in this powerful staging. Tickets are now available at egopoe.org or 267-273-1414. The American Giants Festival.
Natural Lands Trust supports WHYY and is hosting the Cheslin Chase for Open Space on October 25th. This 10K, 5K, and 1.5-mile trail race through the woodlands and meadows of Chesland Preserve in Unionville, Chester County, will culminate in a post-race party with food and beer from Victory Brewing Company and live music by the Mojo Gypsies. Details at natlands.org/Chesland Chase. Natural Lands Trust. Land for life.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane, again getting an update on those thousands of young unaccompanied minors who streamed into the United States from Central America looking for asylum, looking for their relatives. The number of apprehensions is down pretty dramatically, according to reports from the border. These young people, as we were just learning, reported fleeing violence and neglect and abuse. And now they're going to have their day in court to determine if they get to stay or have to go back where they came from. And again, Kathy Tillman, Executive Director of La Puerta Abierta. It's an organization that provides counseling to these young people. Elizabeth Yeager, staff attorney with Hyatt, Pennsylvania, representing these kids in court. And again, to join our conversation, that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Kathy, you said, you know, for some of these young people, they'll witness something that is so horrifying, they just decide, I have to leave, I have to go. Let's say I'm in Honduras or El Salvador or Guatemala. I just go? I just walk it and walk towards the United States?
There are a lot of different ways that they come. You know, sometimes if there's a parent or a family member that can send money to arrange for them to be smuggled, there's a whole economy now that's been built around that. And, you know, I find it fascinating, sort of changes almost from week to week. But basically, these are coyotes who are paid to take some of these kids, oftentimes in groups. There are so many different configurations. I can't even keep track of
really
all of it. But it does create some level of safety in terms, although, you know, we do hear of stories where obviously there's a lot of corruption even in that little economy of smuggling. So it depends on whether or not there's family here, whether there have been some resources sent back to help with the journey. But we do know of some young people that we work with where they literally pack a bag and put on their walking shoes and they just head north. And they don't always get there. I mean, it can take months. Sometimes they get lost. They're oftentimes kidnapped. Right. We know of stories where they've had to smuggle drugs across in order to save or be killed because they encounter a drug gang or whatever. So there are so many different ways that the trip could be intercepted with a lot of danger. So, I mean, we could talk on and on about that, but there are a lot of different ways that they come.
I can only imagine, but the idea that they can find a safe haven in the United States, either in this country or with some relative that might be living here, mm-hmm. That's what they think?
That's what they hope.
Or they hope?
That's what they hope. There have been a lot of interviews that have been done at the border. If you can access the interviews, for instance, online, oftentimes they'll interview young kids, especially boys, and they'll say, "Oh, I'm going to California. I'm going to be a movie star." And there's this little element of grandiosity because they're kids. But then when the questions are asked about, "Well, who are you really going to see?" "Well, I'm hoping to see my mother. I have a phone number." And when the questions are asked, "Well, how long has it been since you've seen your mother?" And they say 12 years. And we've seen videos where the kids just break down and start crying. And clearly there's so many layers of defensiveness that has grown in their souls and their hearts, understandably. And you lift that a little bit and then, you know, some of the truth comes out about what they – it's a variety of things. They're running from danger. They're hoping that their family could be back in their lives. It's such a wide variety of reasons and feelings
It's heartbreaking.
Yeah, experiences.
It's heartbreaking. To you, Elizabeth, I mean, you're a lawyer, and you're going to be representing some of these children in court. So you have to, I assume, you know, find out about why they left, the circumstances of their life in whatever country they were living in, to mm-hmm. figure out how to make your argument, I guess, to the judge about whether they stay or whether they go. How do you approach these young people?
Well, it can be challenging. And it depends on the circumstances and how old the child is and kind of what their experiences have been. But I'll tell you a story about a boy that was in my office just a couple of weeks ago, and I don't often get really, you know, shaken up that much anymore because I hear the same and similar stories a lot, and I'm used to hearing it. But this child was only 10 years old, and I started off by meeting with him alone. And just trying to get him comfortable and asking, oh, so do you know why you're here to see me today? Meaning, I'm a lawyer, this is what court is, this is what a lawyer does. And when I asked him, do you know why you're here? He said, sí, porque me quieren matar. Yes, because they want to kill me. And so that took me back a little bit. But, approaching that with him very kind of gently and getting just minimal information. And then I spoke with his mother, who told me that another adult male relative had been threatened by gangs and then fled. And then so since he was no longer there, the gangs wanted to go after this kid, you know, to get to the family. So clearly a very dire situation. As soon as they could, they sent him up here. And this poor child had been told by other adults in the household, oh, you've got to leave here because you're going to get killed. So these are the things that these children are dealing with that we see all the time. But so, you know, for us, it's a matter of finding out that information. Also hoping that we can connect these children to some kind of therapeutic services that very oftentimes they need, whether that's with Kathy or somebody or somewhere else.
Do you have to be able to verify that information? I'm thinking this is a court of law.
Sure.
And someone can tell you it's sort of a heartbreaking story like that. Do you have to be able to verify that that actually happened?
Well, I mean, the way that you're verifying it is through the evidence that you have available. And oftentimes with these cases, that's the testimony of that child and of other relatives. And that can be one of the challenging things in these cases. For example, if you're pursuing asylum, you're expected to reasonably corroborate with any other evidence you can. And so, you might be expected to have police reports or other documents. But of course, as Kathy said, these are places with, no functioning judicial or legal system that could protect these children and these people. So people aren't going out to the police and making a report or going to seek assistance. They're just fleeing. So,
and do they get asylum if it's clear that if they are forced to go back where they came from, they could be killed in this case or targeted in some way?
No, not necessarily, believe it or not, because to qualify for asylum in particular, you have to show not only that you'll be killed or persecuted, but that you're going to be harmed for some specific reason that's protected under the law. So what asylum law says is that you can be granted asylum if you would be persecuted in your home country because of your race or religion or your nationality or your political opinion or the fact that you're a member of a particular social group that's being targeted. In many of these cases, we have a situation where it's mass violence against everybody. So the challenge in the case is trying to find a way to explain what is the link between the harm that this child will face and one of the protected reasons under the law.
Kathy was talking about that for some of these children, they're escaping the violence within their own home.
Sure.
Is that a reason to provide protection for these children under the court, under immigration court?
Yeah, absolutely. Whether that's through asylum or something else called special immigrant juvenile status, a child who's been abused or neglected or abandoned by their parents or by one of their parents can also qualify for legal relief.
Let me reintroduce the two of you, and that's Elizabeth Yeager. She's a staff attorney with Hyas, Pennsylvania. She represents children in immigration court, also before the Department of Homeland Security. Also with us, Kathy Tillman. She's the founder and executive director of La Puerta Abierta, which also stands for The Open Door, providing mental health services to vulnerable youth and their families in the Latino immigrant community. And we are talking about these unaccompanied minors that came into the United States, a flood of them, frankly, earlier this year, and their status, how they are dealing with their circumstances, and certainly some of the legal challenges that these cases present. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Kathy, I remember back in the summer and some of these families, and sometimes they were with parents, were bused from one place to another, and there were protests outside and people saying, we don't want your diseases. You are a menace to us. It's not our responsibility to deal with your plight, frankly. Mm-hmm. Did that resonate? I mean, did the people in the bus, were they able to understand what these people were saying about them? Do you know?
Well, I mean, that locally in the Philadelphia area, fortunately, that wasn't happening, but not that far away from Philadelphia. I think that in general, excuse me, the folks that we work with know that they are vilified in general by the public. This is obviously a big issue when you are a person that is really on the margins of society. So it's another dynamic that comes into the overall worry and struggle, excuse me, emotionally of the children and the families feeling as though they're already having difficulty trusting and feeling safe in a community, and then knowing that there's this kind of plain and simple hatred that is being projected toward them. It doesn't make it any easier. And, you know, in our program, that's one of the things that we address, is that we really create a safe space. You know, we call it therapeutic space making. And what that looks like really depends on the circumstance and the family and the child, because it's like carving that space out for them, because they know that in the media, even though if they're not English speaking, which, you know, most of them aren't, they're not necessarily knowing the words. But trust me, it's being communicated in Spanish, too. So they do know it. They certainly are bombarded by it. How do they internalize it? Well, we don't. There's so many other things to talk about. We don't talk about that as much. But it certainly doesn't help anything.
So what do you talk about?
What do we talk about?
Everything.
Well, it, you know, every people have asked, you know, what is the typical referral that we get? There's nothing typical. I'm sure Liz could say the same thing. The circumstances are in many ways uniquely different, but the common denominator is this sense of the lack of safety, the lack of feeling that you can trust the people around you and sometimes within your own family.
And including maybe you as well?
Oh, of course. Who are we?
We're strangers.
Right?
In a strange land.
And we work very hard at bringing those walls down. And there are a lot of creative ways that we're able to do that. Fortunately, the space we have in Kensington, we're partnered with North Square Neighborhood Project, which is a big youth program that has a network of amazing gardens. And so many of the kids that we've been working with want to be in those gardens having their sessions. We ran a summer program this past summer. They loved being there. In many ways, it was parts the memories of home that they could remember in a very positive and healing way. So we navigate around, you know, listening to the stories, watching their body language, having the conversations, and then creatively meeting those needs and trying to create those spaces.
You mentioned the fact that for some of these children, they haven't seen, let's say, a mother, a parent in 2, 5, 10, maybe 12 years. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure there's a fantasy about family reunification, but again, these are people that do not know each other.
Yeah, it's absolutely. We actually just launched this past year a reunification group, because we were getting referrals and meeting children who were being reunited, usually with the mother. And it goes badly very, very quickly. And if you could only imagine, like you said, the separation that's oftentimes 8 to 12 years, sometimes more, sometimes less. But so much in the family dynamic has shifted. There's a lot of resentment. There's a lot of questions. Everybody's feeling very stressed. The anxiety is absolutely through the ceiling. And we realized that's how we had to. So we have separate groups for the teens and for the parents in the same space, but they're seen separately so that they could find a place and they meet other people just like them. So that has been very helpful, but we know that nationally there's such a need to address this whole reunification process, as you said.
And if they're teenagers, that, you know, it's just another layer of complexity, because teenagers are complex.
Yeah, universally.
Universally, indeed. Let me get Maria from Harrisburg to join our conversation. Hi, Maria. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. I am Mexican-American, and I work with the undocumented for 15 years. I'm an advocate, and I've done it on my own and with the help of friends. So what I have noticed before this huge rush of kids coming in, I had a call from one of my women that I have helped for years, and she, unbeknownst to me, had her child brought in. I think the one was 6 and the other one was 5, or maybe 6 and 7. Two sisters decided to pay a coyote, to bring them across. They got to the border of Arizona in the desert, and they saw immigration patrol, and the adult coyotes, along with the adults that were in the group, ran and left these two children under a bridge. They were in about 2 foot of water, 1.5 feet of water, filthy, filthy water. And I spoke to the immigration patrol officer, and he told me that those children were filthy, hungry, terrified. They could have been eaten by wolves. They could have been beaten to death out there, or they could have just simply died of thirst. Mm. Anyway, they're in the process now of, they were reunited with their mothers, and now the question is whether they'll let them all stay or not. Mm. But my point was this. The grandmother could no longer take care of the children. This is also happening in Mexico. These countries that do not have good governments or careless governments, and it's dramatic and traumatic, and it's hard for me as an advocate for 15 years to deal with these families. It's nothing but sadness, and all I can do is try to make their lives better along with the help of many of my friends.
Well, Maria, I mean, the fact that you care so much and are trying to help these families, these children in particular, is a real, says something about who you are. I'm looking at Kathy Tillman because I'm sure you can relate to what she's talking about.
Oh, absolutely. And a lot of things are going through my mind. And first of all, you know, thank you, Maria, for what you're doing. One of the things that we know is there are a lot of people doing amazing work. And the network that I referred to earlier of just contact and this kind of collaboration that goes on, you know, I invite you to be part of that, what we call the circle of care of what we're all doing, so that we're all on the same page and we also can support one another, because it is, it's heart-wrenching work and it can be exhausting emotionally in so many different ways. Mm. But I think it's important to find locally, you're not that far from Philadelphia, so, you know, I could put you in touch with folks out there. But find people who are doing similar work and put your heads together about not just what you're doing, but also so that you get the support for what you're doing, because that's really important.
To take care of yourself in dealing with
exactly.
this. I wonder, is that true for lawyers as well, Elizabeth?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, you know, when you're doing this work day in and day out and dealing with really sad stories and hard stories, it can definitely take a toll of you. So it's very helpful for all of us to be well connected with the other people in the field, Kathy and others that are doing this work, to be able to process what we're doing and you know, keep on fighting.
I'm going to pick up on this after this break, but just a quick question back to you, Elizabeth, which is, I mean, is the system working? I mean, as you describe it, it's very complicated.
Yeah, it absolutely is. I mean, and where we're seeing a huge need that's just not getting met, that needs to get met, is for legal services for these children. You know, anyone in deportation proceedings, there are no public defenders. No one's guaranteed a government-appointed lawyer.
Because they're not citizens, right?
Well, because it's immigration court. It's not a criminal court where you're charged and you get appointed a lawyer. Even though the consequences of being deported could be worse than a jail sentence, you know, it could be sent back to your native country, harmed or killed. And yet there's no universal, you know, lawyers for these kids. So that's what we need.
I will pick up on that after this very short break. And again, that's Elizabeth Yeager, staff attorney with Hyas, Pennsylvania. Also with us, Kathy Tillman, founder and executive director of La Puerta Abierta, which stands for the open door. We are talking about the unaccompanied minors that we all saw fleeing into the United States. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Lantern Theatre Company presents Tom Stoppard's masterpiece, Arcadia, extended through November 9th. This comedy of misunderstandings is set up against a passionate quest to unravel the mysteries of history, art, science, mathematics, gardening, and love. Arcadia by Tom Stoppard, on stage now through November 9th at Lantern Theatre Company. Tickets and more information available online at lanterntheatre.org. Lantern Theatre Company supports WHYY.
Supporting WHYY's Simpson Meadows, a retirement community in Dallingtown, PA, in Chester County. Managed by Simpson Senior Services, a nonprofit with a long-standing tradition of care. Simpson Meadows provides personal care for senior adults, along with memory care, respite, and independent living. Special services for respite memory care are offered for a limited time for families who need support for loved ones during the upcoming holiday season. More at simpsonmeadows.org.
Supporting WHYY, the new Center for Comprehensive Venous Health at Christiana Care, providing coordinated care with access to a team of venous specialists in one convenient location. Offering a wide range of treatments for all venous diseases, including deep vein thrombosis, pulmonary embolism, and other less severe vein conditions such as spider and varicose veins. Christiana Care, partnering with you to live a healthier life. For details or an appointment, 855-473-VEIN or christianacare.org/venous health.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. As you certainly remember, earlier this year there was a surge of thousands of unaccompanied minors coming from countries in Central America crossing into the United States. Many of these young people reporting fleeing from violence and sexual abuse and abuse and neglect. Now they are having their day in court, at least some of them, to determine if they get to stay in the U.S. or if they have to go back where they came from. And again, talking with Elizabeth Yeager, staff attorney with Hyatt, Pennsylvania, and she has been representing some of these children in court. Also with us, Kathy Tillman, executive director of La Puerta Abierta, providing counseling to these young people. And again, we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen with your questions and your comments. Elizabeth, let me go back to you, because I was reading that I think it was the Obama administration asked Congress for money for lawyers to represent these children. My understanding is that Congress did not do that. Is that your understanding as well?
Well, so there's been a couple of different efforts that have been going on kind of piecemeal in different places to try to provide counsel to these kids. One is that the federal government did, I guess, through the AmeriCorps program, provide some funding. And so now there are some sites at, I think, some cities where the immigration courts are probably seeing the highest volume of these kids. Some nonprofits are receiving some limited funding to host volunteers who, work for a stipend and do this work for a year or for a little bit more. And I think that some other agencies are getting some limited funding through some other channels. In California, the state government actually just passed a law allocating funding to provide representation for children in California. And in New York, a few years ago now, New York City implemented a program where all detained individuals, we're talking adults here, not children, will be provided with a lawyer. So we've seen this kind of experimentation going on nationally, which I think is really interesting. And one of the things that's come out of that is some studies have been done about the fiscal impact on the government of providing counsel. The benefit that the government gets out of that, that the immigration system gets out of that, is that if you have a lawyer, your case is going to move more quickly through the system. The judge isn't going to have to keep giving you continuances to find a lawyer and to prepare your own case. So it ends up being a lot more efficient for the government if everybody that goes in has a lawyer. And I think especially in the case of children, you could maybe see a bigger impact. So, I mean, I've gotten the sense that, you know, maybe there would be some willingness on the part of the government, if it all seems to make sense financially, to provide counsel, but we haven't seen that happen universally yet.
You mentioned the fact that a local immigration judge, ruled or heard 90 cases in one day. How is that even possible?
Yeah, so when we're talking about cases, there's two kinds of hearings in immigration court, and the first one that is happening on these juvenile docket days are what's called master calendar hearings. It's basically a status hearing. Your very first hearing, maybe your first couple of hearings, will be this master calendar hearing where if it's your first hearing and you don't have a lawyer, the judge will give you time to come back and find a lawyer. If you do have a lawyer, the lawyer is kind of updating the court with the status of the preparation of the case. So each hearing on its own takes three or four minutes. Yeah, they're really, really quick. But as you can imagine, the scene there in immigration court is just folks spilling out of the seats and out into the hallway waiting for their turn.
And are there cases where there might be a 9-year-old innocent in the courtroom by him or herself?
Well, yeah. I mean, usually it's a relative or caretaker, right, or sometimes if you know, somebody else at the family trust to bring the child in. I did see a very small child in a woman's arms, and the child, not the woman, was the one who was in deportation proceedings. But yeah, kids of all ages.
So once you get to the is it a trial? I mean, once you get to the actual proceeding, then it's a matter of presenting evidence and obviously making the argument on the case of your client.
Yeah, it depends what kind of relief you're pursuing. So the child or the lawyer would tell the court, we think the child is eligible for X, Y, or Z, whether that's asylum or a special immigrant juvenile status or a different kind of visa. And then depending on what kind of case it is, the merits of that case might get heard by the immigration judge eventually, or it might go to a different immigration office. It might be in front of an immigration officer or somebody else.
Going back to you, Kathy, and I'm thinking about these young people, you know, waiting to get their day in court, mm-hmm. and the potential worry that, you know, if the judge doesn't grant me my status in the United States, am I going to have to go back to this country that I fled? Are they that far ahead in this process?
Not necessarily. I think that the adults understand the implications of their status, and you know, when we talk about something like removal, that somebody's in removal proceedings, it sounds very daunting. Yeah. And yet, when you say that to a 12-year or for a 12 or a 14-year-old, even to wrap his or her brain around that, it's typically not what they're thinking about from day to day. They're thinking about 1,000 other things. Which is probably the good news. Is there this just chronic underlying worry about their fate? Absolutely, all the time. Not just about their legal status and will they potentially be deported back to their home country and back to all the danger that they've left. But they worry about that also here. You know, I've had young people tell me that when they see a man walking down the street in a suit or they see certain people that present a certain way, they literally have anxiety attacks, how they would describe to us as anxiety attacks. You know, suddenly feeling very hypervigilant and should they behave a certain way. So I think that it's all part and parcel of what we're describing mm-hmm. here, that it's just this generalized anxiety about, you know, who am I in this new community and what's going to happen to me?
Because they're drug dealers in Philadelphia.
Absolutely.
I mean, is that the kind of person that might frighten them?
Drug dealers, you name it. I mean, there are a lot of different things that trigger this kind of fear, and sometimes it could be very immobilizing, or it's just I'm scared, and then they go on with their day. The nice thing about, you know, especially adolescents is that there is a certain, you know, there's a lot of resilience that's part of who they are, and you know, so they might feel one way at 10 o'clock in the morning and another way at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and you know, you work with that about, well, when you felt good, what helped you feel good? And so they get past these worries and these anxieties and function, you know, on a level.
Well, I'm thinking about, I mean, what it must have taken physically, psychologically to make that trek.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, even if you're leaving behind something that terrifies you, to make that trek.
Right, right.
Hundreds the tenacity, of miles. Yeah.
The tenacity is amazing. And they're not necessarily thinking of themselves that way, but we certainly are, and we try to really bring that into the conversation. Not so much the, oh, well, look what you've already survived, so you can do this too, because I don't think that's fair, but more that we really help them see that they have the abilities and the skills and the resources internally to really get through things, and that's part of what we work with.
Are they in school?
That's the one thing that they have the right to, you know, the federal right to education. So, yes, they are in school. Do they stay in school? Well, that's another challenge.
Interesting.
Because so many of the kids have had either no education or a very disrupted education, and now they're sitting in a classroom, sometimes for the very first time, at 15, 16 years old.
And maybe can't read or write.
Oftentimes
or
can't
very
read
rudimentary.
Or write. Yeah, and keep in mind that Spanish isn't always their first language. You know, so they're learning English, but they're surrounded with other peers that maybe are speaking Spanish, but they might have grown up with an indigenous language. So now, you know, these not completely formed brains are having to really go into high gear to just get through each day. And it's amazing how well they do it when they do.
I'm also thinking, Elizabeth, about those young people who are supposed to go to court to have their cases heard, mm-hmm. how easy it could be to sort of disappear into this country. I mean, not to show up in court. If there are multiple addresses, you know, how does the court find out where they're living or who they're living with?
Yeah, well, I mean, that can be a logistical challenge. So these children are sorry, they're coming from ORR custody, being released to a relative. The government should have that address and be serving on them their notice to appear in immigration court. Sometimes do things fall through if people move and somehow the address doesn't get updated correctly. That can happen. Mm-hmm. You know, that's one of the challenges that we work with, is just making sure people call our office. I think I have to go to immigration court. What do I do? Where do I go? And making sure that all of the paperwork has been filed so that they'll get notice of their hearing. And know when to show up. You know, of course, if they don't show up, then they'll be ordered deported in their absence.
And how do you deport a child back to a country? I mean, what is that process?
As with an adult, they would be taken into ICE custody and put on a plane. We've had some of the cases that we deal with in Pennsylvania that our agency is dealing with are children who have not yet been released from ORR care to a relative. And so ORR runs these shelters across the country, and a few of them are here in Pennsylvania. And we are interviewing these children and explaining them their rights, explaining them what their legal recourse might be in immigration court, or if they really don't have any, if they're not going to be successful in any claim. And sometimes the children will elect voluntarily, okay, I'm not eligible to stay here.
I'll go back,
yeah. And so we've had cases of children in these shelters that, you know, okay, I'm not going to stay here in this shelter. I understand I don't have, I'm not really going to win my case. I'll go back home.
And do they? Do they have the money to go back?
They're put on a plane by ICE and sent back to Guatemala or wherever it may be.
We have an email from Bill saying, are there needs for families to set up sponsors or to foster some of these children? Are there?
Absolutely.
Are there needs for that?
Yes. Yeah, yes. There are always needs for the need for foster families. And as an example, Lutheran Children and Family Services, they provide a lot of the foster care. Yes. If this person is interested in pursuing it, you can go online and, you know, they're always looking for foster families, keeping in mind that this is under the federal government. It's not the child welfare system as we know it locally through DHS, et cetera. And it's a different dynamic as foster parents and taking care of these children. There's the language piece. There's, you know, all of the histories that we've been talking about. But there is definitely very, very big need for caring families.
You know, thinking about other humanitarian crises, you know, after the Vietnam War, there were a number of immigrants or people from that war that came to the country, certainly the Holocaust, Somalia, Sudan. Are there lessons from those crises that we can apply to the crisis today of these unaccompanied minors, Kathy?
There are definitely many lessons. Are we learning them?
that's another thing.
You know that expression, what we don't learn from history, we're destined to repeat. So I think we're repeating a lot of lessons that we are either unwilling or unable to learn.
Such as?
Well, I can go on and on about that. But just in the way we actually care about the larger political context of everything we're discussing, this isn't something that just started happening. This has been going on, and you know there are a lot of people that are, I think, implicated in that in terms of just the transnational economy. I'm not an economist, and I certainly am not a politician, but we do know that the way that we develop relationships internationally has a lot to do at the end of the day with that 10-year-old that's coming out of Guatemala and seeking safety here. So there are a lot of lessons that realistically, all the different layers of government and so on that we're talking about, I maintain the somewhat naive position that we all sort of do the best that we know how, but we all can do a lot better. I think that the lesson, on a clinical note, there is a professor at the Harvard School of Public Health who has actually been seeing a lot of parallels between the Lost Boys of the Sudan and what we learned in terms of treatment. And, of course, I'm a clinician, so that's how I'm thinking about this, and working with these unaccompanied minors. So there's been a lot of lessons in the clinical world that, you know, are coming to the surface and applying that, which is very wonderful. And so I think in these little microcosms in the world that we're discussing, there are lessons that we've learned and that we're actually applying. But I think universally, we still have a lot of learning to do.
And those lost boys of Sudan, as they were called, fleeing civil war, violence, all some of the things that we've been talking about. How about from a legal perspective? And Payas, your organization, Hayas, goes back decades, is it not?
Over 100 years, actually. Right. I don't know the date off the top of my head, but late 1800s, our agency started by resettling Jews from the Soviet and Eastern Europe. And so, you know, this is certainly not the first mass migration that we've seen to the U.S. from somewhere in the world, and not the first from Central America either. In the late 80s and early 90s, we had people, you know, fleeing civil war in droves, ending up here in the United States, filing for asylum, seeking asylum because they legitimately, you know, feared for their lives. And yet we're getting stonewalled by the asylum officers who were saying, oh, no, this is just general conflict and violence that we're seeing. And it took a federal class action lawsuit that was filed on behalf of those asylum applicants in order to finally get them the right to a fair hearing. I think the lesson from that is that we need to treat these cases, we need to look at every case individually and give everyone a fair hearing and a fair day in court. You know, another thing is that we've seen time and again situations where there's been a mass population in the U.S. of people from a certain country who, for whatever reason, their country cannot absorb them back. And so the U.S. government will grant a temporary protected status or some other kind of mass status to people from this certain place who are here in the U.S. currently. That's something that's been proposed for these kids. I don't think it's going to happen, but interesting thing to think about.
Indeed. Well, my thanks to both of you for coming in, for your work as well. Elizabeth Yeager, thanks very much.
Thank you.
And she's staff attorney with Hayas Pennsylvania. Kathy Tillman, thank you very much as well.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Founder, executive director of La Puerta Abierta. Go to WHYY.org/radiotimes to find out much more about this program, including how to download podcasts and to find us on Twitter and Facebook. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. Quinn Lipson is our intern this fall. The program produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Builder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens. I'm Marty Moscoe. Thank you so much for joining us.